One person who should perhaps have featured in the 1990s archives we've been hearing is Professor Ross Anderson, Professor of Security Engineering at Cambridge University. Professor Anderson, by 1999, you, I think, were pretty sure that there was little or no danger, and you tried to get into the media to tell them. Is that right?
That's right. We spent 1998 looking at all the university's systems, and the university does pretty well everything that the wider economy does. We run what are, in effect, hotels for students. We've got big financial accounting systems. Our engineering department's got turbo machinery. We treat patients at our hospital. And so we reckon that the university would be a good microcosm for the country as a whole. And having looked at all the systems, we discovered that there wasn't anything that would go seriously wrong, and the things that would go wrong could mostly be fixed by, you know, just turning the equipment off and on again.
So surely this was a cause for you to go out into the radio studios of the land and the television talk shows and put the world at ease.
What I did was to write a report on our findings to reassure people, and we used the university's whole PR machinery to try and spread the word. We sent out a press release to over 900 media organisations, but in the end, there were only two or three radio stations showed any interest. So I ended up getting 2 or 3 minutes of coverage on local radio. The big TV stations and the national newspapers just weren't interested at all.
So did you get the impression there was a kind of millennial fever that actually wanted to hear apocalyptic news about the end of time, as it were, as far as digital world is concerned?
That's exactly what I learned from this whole experience. If it bleeds, it leads, as they say. Yeah. And it's not really news to say, it's all right, nothing's going to go wrong, you're going to be all right.
But to go back further then, was there a time ever that you were worried, or was it only using Cambridge as a testbed that put your mind to rest?
I started to be worried in about 1986. I was putting in a new branch banking system for one of the big banks, and we realised then that it would stop working at the year 1999. We pointed this out to our management, and they said, nope, we're too busy, we can't stop to fix that now, we'll have to fix it later. So this got me thinking. And, you know, when I became an academic in 1992, one of the things that, as a software engineer, you teach your students is that about 30% of big projects fail. Yeah. And this is just something that's been around ever since the 1960s. When you try and do new things, especially when they're big and complex, you don't always succeed. Now, we found ourselves by about 1994 or 1995 with all of the big companies in Britain and America saying that Y2K remediation would be a big project. And on the other hand, we have this professional experience that 30% of big projects either are late or over budget or just never work at all. Mm. Therefore, it was logical to conclude that 30% of big companies would be toast come January 2000. Now, one of the most fascinating problems in software engineering is understanding why that didn't happen.
That's very interesting. So rather than take it as a failure of prophecy or anything else, it's actually revealing. It's a bit like predicting that someone's liver will fail or they'll die of this particular disease. And when they don't, rather than saying, I'm an idiot, saying, ooh, what can we learn from this? Is that what you're suggesting? That there's actually information that's come out of the fact that we didn't suffer from a calamity.
Indeed. Now, I think I know what happened. There's some research going back to the late 1980s, which points out that large system failures, large software project failures, are usually due to the requirements being wrong. People start off building a big system without really understanding what it should do. And it's where you have got unclear requirements or conflicting requirements or requirements that change over time that big systems fail. Now, the one distinguishing characteristic of millennium bug fixing was that you knew exactly what the specification of the system should be. You wanted your system to work in the year 2000 exactly as it had worked in 1999 or 1997.
Was it just a question of allocating more bits to storage of real numbers, as we would regard real numbers?
Well, that was the technical aspect of the fix. But what we learned from the Y2K fiasco as a whole was that what you have to concentrate on when you're trying to build big complex systems is the specification, the requirements, right, what you're trying to do. And this gives us another insight into, for example, why it is that 70% of big government projects fail. Now, how should this happen? In private industry, you can accept that 30% of big projects will fail because profit is the reward for risk. And if company directors aren't taking risks, they're not doing their jobs. But civil servants are much more risk averse. So you would expect that instead of 30% of government projects failing, it might be 10%. But in fact, it's 70%.
Yes. It's the inverse of what goes on in the private sector.
Exactly so. Now, I believe that this is because in the public sector, because of the pressures on politicians and media-driven politics, specifications are either forever changing. Ministers need to announce a new initiative every month.
Yeah.
So at the end of a three-year system development cycle, what's now being promised to the electorate is quite different from what the engineers were told to start building 3 years ago. Or else the specifications are a matter of conflict. Ministers want to do one thing in the health service, doctors want to do another.
Yeah.
And it's because of these changing requirements and conflicting requirements that we see so many government IT projects failing.
I suppose you could argue that in the current economic climate, or the one we've been experiencing for the last year now or so, in the light of the Y2K fiasco, if one can call it that, it was actually a sort of reprieve, we've learned a lot, not just about systems, but about humans. In fact, you were talking about it was a bank, as it happened, that you warned in 1986 would fail in 1999. They said, well, we're too busy to forget about it. That's how a human being, that's how I would respond. You know, I see I've made something and the picture's going to fall from the wall in 2 weeks' time, to hell with it. I'm only concerned with now, because it's a human failing. We don't plan ahead. Plus, the actual drawing up of the systems in themselves, you're saying, needs more planning, more forethought. Again, I never planned an essay. And whenever I wrote programs, I certainly never did the flow charts that you're supposed to do. So you're saying, in a sense, that all this complex mathematics, all these algorithms, all these astonishing interface between abstract thought and technological machinery is still at the mercy of basically human failings that we all recognise when it comes to tidying bedrooms, you know, doing DIY and all the human activities that we undertake.
Well, absolutely. Now, the fascinating thing over the next 30 years is going to be what happens as our society becomes a society of complex socio-technical systems. Mm. Because systems are no longer just about machines or just about people. They're about both. They're about human beings and software interacting in all sorts of ever more complex ways. Think of Facebook. Think of Google. Yes. Think of the internet. Now, socio-technical systems have been around for a long, long time, thousands and thousands of years. You know, historians will talk about the difference between the Roman army and feudal armies in terms of what the different structures of organization delivered. And until very recently, this was thought to be a really dry, boring subject. You know, how could anybody possibly get excited about the history of administration? But now, of course, the world is turning thanks to technology, and all of a sudden, how you get machines, people together in some framework of organisation becomes an absolutely critical and fascinating problem.
Yes, that's odd, isn't it? Because actually one of the early names for an IT manager was a systems analyst. The subject was systems analysis, wasn't it?
Yes, in the old days, the business of building systems was broken up into a number of steps. The systems analyst would try and figure out what should be done. The programmer would program it, the tester would test it, and then you would roll it out and see what the users felt. But what we're now beginning to realise is that a much more iterative and evolutionary style of development makes sense. You get people who add large numbers of small features to existing systems and keep on testing them with users as you go along. And this means that instead of going from A to B by means of a small series of large jumps, each of which has got a lot of risk associated with it, you take a more natural approach with an awful lot of small evolutionary incremental changes. And this is how the world is more and more going to go.
I suppose the clincher, as far as the Y2K bug is concerned, is that the various countries who did absolutely nothing to address the problem, like South Korea, Italy, I believe, the Czech Republic, suffered not one whit.
Well, exactly. This is something that I pointed out back in 1997. I did a survey of our research students and postdocs who had industrial experience back home in their own countries. And it turned out that in places like Korea Telecom, for example, was doing nothing. It took the view, well, hey, if it breaks, we'll fix it. And then you had British Telecom, which was spending £500 million on bug fixing. And they couldn't both be right. They were using the same sort of equipment on the same sort of scale. And so the fascinating thing that we observed in the end was that the Koreans actually called it right.
That's wonderful. Now, just to pinch the loaf, as it were, we've talked a little about Alan Turing, who's often considered the father of computing, and it so happens that at the same college in the same university, the one you used as a microcosm of the wider economy, King's College, Cambridge, there was a writer, a very unlikely name to mention in these circumstances, E.M. Forster, who mm-hmm. wrote a book with short stories in it. One of the short stories was called The Machine Stops. And it's, surprisingly for Forster, a science fiction story about people who live in a kind of internet world, which is not just internet, it controls their climate, their environment, everything they have access to, their reading matter, their music and their communications. And one day, it stops. And it's a marvellous story. He was writing it round about the time, as I say, Turing was actually playing with the idea of a machine for purely analytical, mathematical reasons. He wasn't to know it was going to turn into a physical entity. But I just wondered if you could posit some future disaster scenario, an equivalent of Y2K. Will the machine stop? Can the internet stop? Can it judder to a halt? And if it does, now are so many physical machines attached to it that it would be a physical disaster for us?
I believe that there is a risk, a small risk, but still a risk, of technological civilization being damaged by a big systems failure. 10 years ago, when we were worrying about this stuff, the internet wasn't high on our list of priorities. We asked ourselves, what happens if email stops? And we said, hey, we'll get some work done. But nowadays, the world is different. Nowadays, if you break your leg and go to hospital, the X-ray image isn't kept on a server in the hospital, but a server in Swindon. So if the internet goes down, you're going to receive World War I field hospital grade treatment for your broken leg. They'll basically have to set the bone by touch. And there's so much now that depends on the internet that if it goes down, people will in fact die. Now, there are various internet technological things that could go wrong. If, for example, all the Windows PCs in the world got infected with a worm, which started bombarding the root name servers. But perhaps the biggest vulnerability that we've got in technological civilization, as far as I understand it, is the supply of electric power. Because if that goes off, then everything else does. And after 2 or 3 days, when emergency supplies for things like mobile phone masts and so on went out, we would be in a real problem. Now, the sort of thing that could cause widespread electric power failure might be, for example, an extremely severe solar storm.
Yes.
It could also be brought down by hostile action, by technological means, or perhaps by malicious software installed by foreign countries. And in fact, one of the things that we work on is the security of industrial control systems. So yes, there is a concern there. But if there is a big risk to technological civilization, I would say that it is most likely to start at electric power.
Well, you've painted a hell of a nightmare scenario there, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to sleep again. Just give me some figures, if you dare, as to the likelihood of such a scenario coming into being.
It's difficult to give figures for something like that because you're out of the area of risk, where you can calculate odds, into the area of uncertainty, where you've simply no idea what the odds might be. But by way of reassurance, big companies that run things like electric power stations and oil refineries and so on are aware of these problems and are working on them. And, you know, they're a topic of research for us and for other people. So people are worrying about and figuring out what they can do about these
things. It makes me think of my scientific hero, the great Professor Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning lecturer, author, writer, genius, all-round magnificent man, and indeed tom-tom player, bongo player. And he, as a very, very young man, worked on the Manhattan Project developing the atom bomb. And he'd left New Mexico and was driving through, or in the taxi, on through Manhattan. And he remembers looking up at men working on skyscrapers, thinking, why are you bothering? There's going to be no future. There will be no planet in 10 years. Why bother to build skyscrapers? And he looks back on that. And it was absolutely clear to him that there could not be a planet Earth with humans sustained in the way that it had been for 60,000 years or whatever. It could never happen. You know, it would end. He had built the end of the world. And maybe we just have to remember that it isn't as big a threat as the nuclear bomb seemed. And so far we've weathered that one. so far? Of course, we only have to not weather it once for it to be the end of everything.
Well, absolutely. Now, if we had a failure of the national grid for more than 3 or 4 days, that might cause all sorts of industries to have problems. And a planning scenario that people use is that it might kick off a recession for several years. But we're having one of those already.
Quite. And the other thing about power is, as they say, and my dear, the smell.